Welcome to The Unconventional Path, entrepreneurship and innovation stories and ideas. Hello, I'm Bala Musitz, coming to you from upstate New York. I'm a former three-time entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and business school professor.
And coming to you from Münster, Germany, I'm Mike Wasserman, professor of international management at the Münster University of Applied Sciences. Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoy listening to this as much as we've enjoyed creating it. A lot of people ask us why we do this, and every week I say the same thing. It's certainly not to make money, but Bala and I both really enjoy learning from smart and interesting people about how the world's changing, how innovation and entrepreneurship are changing, and we like to overlay our observations and compare them with the lessons we've each learned over three-plus decades as entrepreneurs, investors, managers, and professors. To do this, we've put together our network of interesting friends, former students, and business partners, along with other people that we've met recently, to bring you interesting stories, ideas, and insights into innovation, entrepreneurship, and the people that take unconventional paths to find happiness at work and in life.
This week's guest is Jim Williams from Upper Hudson Coffee Roasters. Jim has a fascinating background. In addition to starting Upper Hudson Coffee Roasters, where he buys 50-pound bags of coffee beans and roasts them and sells them to retail outlets. He has also been a dean of students at a military prep school. He has worked for a professional cycling team, and for a period of time, he was even a male stripper. So it was a very interesting conversation for sure.
I agree, Bala. This was a story about life's second and third chances. And, you know, I think many people know this, that there's a lot of ups and downs that people face as they grow older. And people have choices about how to approach those ups and downs. And, yeah, as you'll hear in the coming minutes, Jim has certainly taken a really interesting path as he worked through a series of challenges and a pretty interesting set of issues that he faced. But before we get into it, we have exciting news. And we are proud to announce that our podcast is now brought to you in part by the law firm of Phillips Lytle LLP.
I have worked with the key entrepreneurship practice partners at Phillips Lytle for over 20 years. They are nationally recognized attorneys that take an entrepreneurial approach to legal matters and have a long history of success with startup businesses.
Yeah, Bala, we are excited to have Phillips Lytle as our show sponsor because you and I both know that they think like entrepreneurs. They take a pragmatic approach to getting things done, and they spot issues before they become problems. So we can confidently recommend them. So whether you need help starting, funding, or selling a business from single-person startups to nine-figure exits, the attorneys at Phillips Lytle can help.
Phillips Lytle is my go-to team for guiding startup businesses down the path to success. I have worked with these guys for over 20 years, and every time I see them at the table, whether they're sitting next to me on my side of the table or if they're sitting on the other side of the table representing the company, I know it's going to be a good process because they're highly skilled, they're reasonable, and they know what they're doing. So for more information, contact Phillips Lytle partner, Rich Honan. If you're an old school phone person like Mike and I, you can give Rich a call at 518-618-1225. Or if you're of the generation that prefers online communication, you can reach Rich directly from his firm's website at phillipslytle.com. Let me spell that for you. It's phillipslytle.com.
And it'll be great for us if you let Rich know that you heard about Phillips Lytle from listening to the Unconventional Path podcast. So it's an interesting story that we've got coming up with Jim Williams. Let's get right to it.
Hello, folks. Today I'm here with Jim Williams, a really interesting person that I met through my adventures of being a ski patrolman at Gore Mountain. And I got to know him a little bit, and he has a really fascinating background that is, I think, the epitome of unconventional. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Hey, glad to be here.
Excellent. So, Jim, can you describe where we're at right now?
Yeah, we're sitting in the middle of the Adirondack State Park, 6 million acres of public and privately owned land, of which I actually own 3 1/4 of. Lifelong dream to build my own home, and I was able to accomplish that. And we're sitting at maybe a 10-foot long pine slab dining room table.
Did you make the dining room table?
Well, Mother Nature made the wood. I was able to get it down, cut it up, and yes, I made the table.
Excellent. So this is a whole nother skill that I learned when I walked into your place that you have that I didn't know you had, which was building a home and woodworking and all that kind of stuff.
The first thing I ever built was a garage right across the driveway. So I wanted to make sure I could build a garage and have it stand up at least for a year before I started the house. But it was always a lifelong goal. So it was fun to achieve. I'm by no means a professional carpenter, and I don't think I would want to work for anyone else building a home. I know where all my mistakes are, so I'm okay with that.
Yeah, but that's not your primary business. So when you're at a social event and someone comes up to you and says, "Hey, Jim, pleasure to meet you. What do you do?" How do you answer that question?
It's a little easier now. It's had many different answers in the past. But at 53 years old now, I can comfortably say I'm a coffee roaster.
Excellent. So you have a coffee business? Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I, four years ago now, I had been in education for 23 years and had an aha moment, which many times you have when you have a health issue. My aha moment came when I had to, I drove to the hospital for a surgery that was about a 50-50 shot of survival. And I was sitting in the parking lot trying to figure out what to do with my car keys. And I didn't know whether I should bring them in and give them to the nurse because someone might need those keys if things didn't go well. So after debating and scratching my head for a little bit, I hit them in the gas cap and left a note on the dashboard that said, if this car is still here 5 days from now and it needs to be moved, it's yours. Things didn't go so well.
Oh my God.
So that was my aha moment. I was in California at the time working in school administration, and I hadn't ever lived full time in the house I built. So I said, "What are you doing? Go home and back to the Adirondacks and live." With no real plan other than, you know, confidence in my ability to figure it out and to find a good balance in life. And coffee has always been an extremely important part of my life in many aspects, from starting to drink coffee with my Italian grandmother at 12 to leaving the house at 17, saying, as long as I make enough money that I can drink good coffee, I'm doing okay. To touring plantations in the 90s in Costa Rica, and then, you know, to today, where I was really interested in how coffee was grown and the processing that it goes through, and never thought much about the roasting end of things until I actually got green coffee cherries and pitted them and got the coffee beans and tried to roast them in a popcorn popper and had probably the worst cup of coffee in my entire life. And of course, when I was in education, I taught science. So the scientist in me kicked in and said, "Well, I can do better than this," and continued to work and experiment. And I needed people to try my coffee. And I had willing drinkers and then willing purchasers and said, "Well, maybe there's an opportunity here." And at the same time, when I came back, I had taken a job with a solar company. I was a 49, 50-year-old guy hauling solar panels up a roof. And I'm proud to say I was out working the young bucks because I was chemical free at work. And it was a temporary job that allowed me to then build my coffee business until that was able to sustain me.
Yeah. So let's talk about the coffee business a little bit. So I think probably most people listen to the podcast drink coffee, but they have no idea of sort of where it comes from and what the process is to get it to inside the bag that I buy. So talk to us about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, so much depends on there's coffee growing regions in the globe, and most of those are, you know, very temperate climates. Coffee does better with cool nights, warm days. Shade grown is going to produce a better fruit. Soil quality is extremely important, as well as the variety of the bean. So, you know, I use a Costa Rican coffee. I drank a lot and roasted a lot of bad beans before I got to finding the bean that I thought fit the flavor profile of people here in the Adirondacks. But coffee is a shrub that produces a cherry, and it's the cherry is red when it's ripe. It needs to be depulped. Sometimes the cherry has a hard shell on it, so it needs to be cracked. Other times it's just like a bran layer. So there's a lot of washing and processing that occurs on the field or in the home country, and then it's bagged up into burlap bags and shipped out to various locales.
Mm-hmm. So you buy it in a burlap bag?
Yeah, I get my beans come from the Terrazu region of Costa Rica. It's all grown above 4,000 foot elevation in volcanic soil. And it comes from the beans that I get come from a cooperative. So for me, I looked at organic and I looked at free trade and really felt that was important for my brand. But I settled on this bean. It's not certified organic because it is coming from a cooperative of small individually owned farms in Costa Rica, no corporation farms. So it would be cost prohibitive for each of those small farmers to be certified organic. But it is free trade, and the people are living on the land and caring for it.
Oh, excellent. So we've had someone else join us here in the room. Will you want to introduce our guest?
Yeah, the guest that, and you'll hear maybe Hedgy squeak and the bone chewed, is my year and a half year old golden retriever, known as Bean, who is chewing on my hand at the moment. He has been decaffeinated, so I'm hoping he will soon calm down.
Excellent. So once you get the beans here, I assume you get them shipped here to the Adirondacks?
Yeah, they come on a container vessel into Continental Terminals in Newark, New Jersey, and then I get them freighted up here, and I still have a connection at Apex Solar, so they have a loading dock, so they'll get unloaded at Apex, transferred to a buddy who has a pickup truck, and I'm getting a shipment tonight. He'll come up, and I'll cook him a dinner that is usually steak, Angus beef, something that I've traded with another vendor at the farmers markets for a bag of coffee. So it's a great little circle.
So there is this nice barter element to your business.
Absolutely, yeah. So cheese, fruits, vegetables, meats, it's endless. Pickles. There's so many people making so many great things out there. It some of these farmers markets, and they are like me. Living, you know, their life, their American dream, and selling great products.
Yeah. So once you get the bag of beans, what happens next?
So I get them. The biggest challenge for me is actually carrying the 150 pound bags up the stairs into my garage loft, which has been certified by New York Ag Markets as a food processing center. So I had to get licensed. And once they're up there, then I have a little small 5 pound roaster that I roast 5 pounds at a time, and I'm able to do about 4 roasts an hour. So I'm a real small roaster, and I have a computerized roaster that's got thermal couplings in it. You're always trying to you know, at this point now, I know the roasting profile that I want is coffee goes through three different phases in the roasting cycle, and you can manipulate the heat, the air, and the time to take a bean and have it perform differently just by roasting.
Oh, wow. So you can take the same bean, and depending upon how you roast it with all these variables, you can get a different flavor.
You get a completely different flavor. Yeah. Yeah. So you want to, you know, for me, I'm in the Adirondacks of New York, and, you know, I love coffee, but it was always a challenge to find a good cup of coffee. And I know the locals all, we don't have Starbucks up here. We don't have Dunkin' Donuts up here. We've got Stewart's Coffee. And if you're able to get the Stewart's cup of coffee 2 minutes after it's brewed, maybe you'll get a cup that's drinkable. And I don't mean to be a coffee snob by any means. But there's a whole new realm of coffee out there that people don't know. I, for one, was married and divorced, and when I started roasting coffee, it was my goal to roast beans in a way that would not remind me of divorce. So when I sat down in the morning, I didn't want to have burnt and bitter in my cup of coffee. So
that's an excellent line.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, if you don't get that Stewart's cup within the first couple of minutes, it is divorce in a cup.
Excellent. So you do 4 roasts an hour, did you say? 5 pounds, that's 20 pounds an hour.
Yeah, I can do about 20 pounds an hour. In you know, commercial roasters will do 100 pounds
sure.
in a roast, up to 400 pounds in an hour. So, you know, with my size, people are really getting a consistent product in the sense that the beans are able to distribute throughout the drum and the roaster without being buried by other beans. So you want to have even heat distribution. And, you know, with a smaller roaster, you're able to achieve that and really have a good high quality coffee that
yeah.
way.
So you're a one person operation?
I am, yes. Back to that original question. I say I'm a coffee roaster, but if she's cute and she's asking and I need to impress her, I'll tell her that I'm the CEO of Upper Hudson Coffee. But I'm also the delivery man. I'm the sales guy. I'm the logistics coordinator, the graphic artists. I am it's truly a one-man show. Yeah.
Yeah. So in many ways, there's a lot of coffee brands out there.
Yeah.
And so establishing a new brand and sort of that brand identity and then building your customer base. Talk to us about how you sort of did that and how you think about that.
Yeah. So I wanted to roast for the local people and expand their palate and passion for coffee. As well as build a business that at the end of the day, I could feel really proud of. I love where I live. I've guided the Hudson River here in North Creek, since I was 18 years old and loved being on the river. And there's a lot of really unique history here. And I had a dual degree in school with both science and history. So I wanted to celebrate the area that I lived, and hence the name Upper Hudson Coffee came about. When I was roasting illegally, I roasted under my nickname Jetson. But really, I didn't want the coffee to be about me. I wanted it to be about the Adirondacks and where we live. So each blend has a person on the front of the bag connected through either history or an association with the river, both currently and historically. So my most popular roast is, of course, the Roosevelt blend, and that's for Teddy Roosevelt, who found out at the North Creek train station that he was actually president of the United States when McKinley was shot and subsequently got septus. He was up in the Adirondacks at the source of the Hudson River camping. So I wanted to celebrate the local area, and that way the locals could identify with it as their coffee. There was some strategic thought that went into it because geographically where we are, without question, we're on the upper Hudson River, but the people in New York City consider Poughkeepsie the upper Hudson River, and even though we're almost 150, 200 miles north of Poughkeepsie, so all along the Hudson River, people could identify with it as theirs. Roosevelt likewise has connections downstate as well. So while I'm celebrating the upper Hudson River, there's also a connection to people throughout the Hudson Valley region. So it allowed me to have a greater geographical reach than, say, a Lake George coffee would.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to brew and make a coffee that people could expand their palate on and identify as their own. Likewise, we're also in a tourist area. And being in a tourist area, people want to bring a piece of the Adirondacks home with them. And a non-perishable bag of coffee works. And people that go visit other people bring a piece of the Adirondacks with them. That being said, I also wanted to have a model that if I ever felt motivated enough, or if I ever wanted to actually have my dream of a coffee shop on some Southern California beach, that I had an avenue to grow and potentially franchise. And the model, you know, and I should be careful saying this to all your listeners, because it might creep up out there, and I have my own competition. But the model that I kind of created with the coffee could work in the Finger Lakes region. It could work in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It could work in just about any tourist town in America where there are locals that identify with it and are proud of it, and tourists that come and want to take a piece of it home.
Yeah, so it's. I just thought of this, and I mean this in a good way, sort of like the t-shirt model, right? You can have t-shirts from Phoenix, Arizona that say, you know, I was in Phoenix, but it gives you that identity with that geographic region.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I thought of how I could franchise it, but you know, those thoughts are definitely on the burner at this point.
So when you started, How did you think about distribution and sales? How did that process work for you?
When I started, I just had a goal of, okay, what my first goal was, how many bags of coffee do I need to sell so that I don't have to go to this solar company warehouse every day? And I had a goal in mind and quickly achieved that. And what I found out when I started to go around and talk to wholesalers, my goal was to have one country Adirondack store in each town to carry my coffee. I didn't want to saturate. I just wanted to be in every town. Mm-hmm. And then likewise, supplement that with some of the more popular cafes or camps, I should say, because they're really not hotels, but lodges here that serve coffee, to have them carry it and serve it. So I ended up in a couple of different restaurants that are high quality, some great establishments that I wholesale to. And then likewise, I do three main farmers markets to extend my reach. And some of those are more tourist-based farmers markets. And the combination of them has worked out really well for me.
Yeah. So if I'm listening to this and I want to get some upper Hudson coffee,
yeah,
how do I do that?
Well,
and I'm not living in the Adirondacks.
Yeah. So
can I do that?
Yeah, you can do that. And that was some of the idea of the farmers markets was we have a lot of people that come here and they're second homeowners and they vacation here. And of course they will drink my coffee, but then they go home and I have a little square store. I'm 53 again, so I'm not technologically advanced. But I do have Square and am able to process credit cards, and they have a feature where they will host a website without having to have a domain name and you know, pay a hosting company to have your website. So I made a little web store on Square and have all my coffee available there, and I'm a hack at social media, but I do have a Facebook page and an Instagram with links to that. So on the back of my bag, I said, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, and they can find their way to me. And again, I find that I sell more to a generation a little younger than I am. They're very nimble with, yes, with, you know, technology. So they found me and can buy it online, but it's fun to ship to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and into Vail, Colorado, and you know, to Sanibel Island in Florida and San Diego, California, and see where the coffee goes.
Yeah,
and then likewise have people send me pictures of them enjoying my coffee. So I've Upper Hudson Coffee has made it to the research station on the South Pole, and it's made it up Mount Hood.
Wow!
And it's made it up to the Arctic Circle in Norway, and yeah, so it's got a pretty good geographical reach. I just wish I could be as well traveled as my coffee.
So if I search on Upper Hudson Coffee, I will come across your website.
Yeah, just a Google search in the Facebook page, and also the Square store will show up.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. So you're still a one-person operation.
Yep.
And it sounds like from our previous conversations sitting around the ski patrol hut that's a conscious, that's a deliberate decision on your part to remain small and to sort of have a life-work balance.
Yeah.
So can you share your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I were 25 years younger and I'd started this and hadn't gone through the medical, you know, issue that I have, I probably would have tried to grow and go head to toe with Green Mountain Coffee, because while they make great coffee, the big thing about the Green Mountains of Vermont is it's actually the Adirondacks that make them beautiful. And actually our mountains are greener than theirs anyways. But where I am at life right now, it's important for me to have balance. And, you know, I have many, many passions, and a life out of balance isn't necessarily a life well lived. So, being a one-man show, I don't have to worry about employees. Being a one-man show, I don't have to stress over the responsibility of not just employing somebody, but then you have you're really committed to their family and their life, and you invest in a lot of other people, and in many aspects that can take away from your own enjoyment. And I want to have a socially conscious company. And if it's only me right now that I'm socially conscious to, and my life is well balanced and I'm a happy employee, then that's really important. So it allows me, because a lot of my businesses are in the Adirondacks north of where we are sitting, they close down for the winter. And it allows me to still make a decent wage with my other wholesale accounts, but it slows enough that I can go up and work as a ski patroller at Gore and pretend I'm a 19-year-old ski bum all over again. You know, and that's a good balance for me. If you don't get outside in the winter here, then you'll go stir crazy. But I like to fly fish, and I like to work with wood and build things, and I like to, you know, get on my bike and ride miles and make sure that I burn enough calories that I don't have to buy new pants when I drink beer. So it's about balance for me.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. So let's take a step back. Where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, I was born in Rochester, New York. So in many aspects, if you were to talk about fish in the Adirondacks, I'm what's called a rainbow trout. I've been here for a long time, but I wasn't actually born here. But you're widely accepted as being somewhat native. The brook trout, of course, is the native who was born here and always lived here. And the brown trout is a recent transplant to the Adirondack waters. So I was born in Rochester and grew up there, but knew at a very young age that the suburban lifestyle was not mine. I love my parents to death. I think they're wonderful people, but they provided me with an example of what I didn't want in life. Dad was middle management at Xerox. Mom worked for a tool and die company. And they all had big dreams and aspirations that they talked about and never really acted or they were left unfulfilled. So I knew at a young age that wasn't going to be me. I was going to follow my passions and work for me always had to be something that I loved to do and that I was excited to wake up and go to. So I got out of Rochester at a relatively young age and actually went to high school in Lake Placid. So was a hockey player and played hockey at a pretty good school up there. So that's what brought me to the Adirondacks.
Got it.
Yeah. And we always vacationed up here as kids. So
yeah,
it was a part of our life from a young age.
And did you go to college?
I did, yeah. So I left Northwood Prep, where I was going to high school, as a junior. And this is before college placement. But I had to complete my freshman year of college in order to get my high school diploma. So
sounds like a catch-22.
It was, yeah. My first stint at college was at Nazareth College of Rochester, and it had just gone co-ed. So having been a hockey player playing at Northwood with very few girls, I wanted to switch the dynamic a little bit. So it was an 8-to-1 ratio girls to guys, and I went there and studied biochemistry. And I lasted my year, got my high school diploma, started my second year. In about October, I realized that I probably was going to take some time off. And by the middle of October, I was living in Killington. Told all my teachers I had a unique job experience in the travel industry, even though I was tuning skis at night, and told them I really valued their course and I would come back and be there for the final exam in December. So in a sense, I skipped class from mid-October until December and came back, and I gave myself a week to track down people that were in my class and get their notes and cram and study. And I told them I would keep up with the work, and I hadn't done anything. And I came back, and somehow I was able to pull a 3.2, I think, for that semester.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't go back to school for 5 years, not until I was 23, and was a raft guide in the summers, and started guiding here, and then would go to Maine in the summers and guide, and back to Killington, and live the life of a ski bum raft guide.
Yeah, yeah. And so what happened after that? You went back to school?
Yeah, I did. I mean, as all good stories go, met a girl. She was a raft guide as well, soccer player. And she was from Maine, so she was spending fall semester in the University of Southern Maine. And, you know, it was time to go back to school. And at that point, I went back as a history major. And I was on the fast track then. 2.5 later, I graduated with a degree in both biology and history. So I had enough credits in biology, and I took electives in pathophysiology and microbiology, and was able to get a double degree.
Mm-hmm.
And she finished up as well. And the idea was to go into education at that point. History I found amazing, and didn't have good history teachers, and thought that's what I would be, was a history teacher. But as it turned out, the first job I got was back at Northwood School in Lake Placid, as a hockey coach and a biology teacher.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that started sort of your teaching career?
That started...
Because being a coach is being a teacher as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I was a triple threat. So I lived in the dorm, supervised kids, was a hockey coach, and also a teacher. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I stayed at Northwood for 9 years.
Okay.
And then I had an old sage that told me, you need to leave. And I really didn't understand why. And he said, if you stay here, you'll be like me. You'll be 65 with no equity. And he goes, you need to leave, because then you can get a larger salary and you can build equity. And I took his advice, and I went down to Saddle River, New Jersey, took a job at a school there, and bought my first house, which was a tiny little 800 square foot home without a basement, and gutted it and fixed it up, and then the housing market blew up, and I did really well, knowing that I was there just to be a little personal Robin Hood to myself. I made sure that I kept an eye on the housing market, so I did well with that and sale of that house. And at the same time, I had been involved in pro cycling, and was able to make the transition to managing pro cycling teams for 2 or 3 years full time.
Whoa! So pro cycling just sort of popped up here out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
hockey coach,
go to
Saddle River, teaching job.
Yep.
More responsibility in that job, I assume.
Yeah, I was a department chair.
Okay.
Yep.
At a private school.
Private school. Yep.
And then so bridge us to the pro cycling.
Pro cycling came. I was a hockey player, so. Watching the 1980 Olympics and Eric Heiden crush the competition by winning 5 golds in speed skating, I said to myself, well, what does he do to train? And he used the bike. And my passion with the bike began the same time as I was a 12-year-old hockey player, and trained on the bike. Never thought it would be a career, but I loved it. And when hockey ended, my passion for cycling didn't. And when I was at Northwood, I had more time, and I had summers. And I got out of the summertime rafting and pushed myself on the bike as far as I could, and trained and lived the life of a pro racer, at least for 2 months. And so cycling was a huge part of my life as well, usually mostly as recreation and in racing, but, you know. And I progressed pretty well up the ladder of regional riders, but it got me in contact with managers and directors of teams, and eventually I was hired to work with a Canadian outfit, and I worked with them until one of their riders had an issue with bad blood bad urine as well, and the sponsor withdrew, and I was able to get snatched up by a sports management company out of Wisconsin, and then spent 3 years traveling the world and managing cycling teams.
Oh wow! So you left a teaching job in New Jersey at that time?
Yeah, because when I sold my house and I didn't have a place to live, so I just transitioned, because I'd already been working with teams.
Yeah.
And I spent 2 years living out of a suitcase and coming back here to the Adirondacks and pitching my tent and living out of a canvas condo. It's what I called it. building the garage, which eventually turned into my where I roast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I left cycling. I had done 300 days a year on the road for two consecutive years, and I was pretty tired of travel at that point. I didn't want to go to Bermuda. I didn't want to go to Stuttgart, Germany for the World Championships, where actually Oktoberfest, why didn't I go? Oktoberfest is. I just wanted to come back and spend time in my tent in the Adirondacks. Yeah. So I was able to get a job back up in Lake Placid at a second school there, which was National Sports Academy, and was able to teach exercise physiology there and became a dean of students.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you got into the fun job of being responsible for a whole bunch of students.
Yeah, the discipline end of things. Yes. You make friends there, and parents love you.
Yeah, yeah. But I so let me ask you this question. Being a dean of students, you know, certainly has a lot of responsibility. You get to interact with some students that you really enjoy, and you get to interact with some students that are a challenge. What did you learn from that experience?
What I learned from it is you go in with a, everyone goes into their life with biases, and kids and students get the benefit of the doubt because they're young. But what I learned is that kids are no different than adults. And every kid, there is a key that you are responsible to finding in order to reach them so that you can make an impact on their life. And it's really no different with adults. So as you walk through your normal life, there's people that you make quick judgments about of, oh, they're this or oh, they're that, or, you know, because of your quick observation or interaction. In reality, you have no idea what's going on in their life. And if you take the time to figure out what's going on in their life, it explains a lot of their current behaviors.
Yeah.
So in dealing with people, that's important. And likewise, if there's anything I learned, it's just patience for people, talking to people, communicating with people, trying to communicate to them on their level, even if you're not smart enough to communicate on their level.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me of one of the few things I remember from elementary school was reading a book about Abraham Lincoln.
Yep.
Being a history guy, maybe you're aware of this. And the story goes something like he was on the floor of Congress talking to another congressman. This is before he was president. And one congressman said, gee, you know, I think, pointed to somebody up in the, on the floor and said, gee, that guy's a real jerk. And Abraham Lincoln said, yeah, I feel the same way. I think I need to get to know him better.
Yes. Yeah. It's true. And some people will come to my table and they'll say that they're a coffee snob. And when you can talk to them and show an interest or show a passion, a lot of that snobbery disappears.
Yeah. Yeah. So our third guest here, Bean the dog, has just torn apart and disintegrated one of his stuffed toys, I see.
Yes, Hedgehog, Hedgy, as we call him.
is no longer.
No, he's been eviscerated, and his squeaker is now on the table and out of Bean's mouth.
So is this a common theme with Bean?
Hedgehogs, yes. They're his favorite by far, and he's nervous about us talking, so there's no rocks to play with here in the house. So
that's how he calms his nerves.
This is how he calms his nerves.
Yeah, yeah. All of Hedgehog's stuffing is now on the carpet. Oh, wow, great. So what else is there about you in this very interesting life that you led in this journey that I haven't asked you that we should talk about?
I mean, there's some R-rated chapters for sure. that came up, that girl that I met that got me back to school. Eventually we did get a divorce, and under not the best of circumstances, not that there was animosity, but because of influences at the school that played a role, along with a head of school that didn't really do the right thing.
So you guys both worked at the same place?
Yeah, we worked together, and she struggled with alcoholism and got sobriety, and another teacher used her desire for alcohol to get her drinking again and had an affair with her. And the head of school didn't find out until a year later when I finally spilled the beans, because this member was superior of both of ours. There was the potential grounds for sexual harassment, and as opposed to dealing with that individual in a moral and ethical way, he dealt with that individual in a way that really was to hide appearances.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks after he found out, we had a sexual harassment policy. So that kind of that definitely bothered me. So I wanted to have a conversation about morality with that head of school. So I tried to figure out how I could best do that. So I did spend some time as a exotic dancer for bachelorette shows. And everyone in town kind of knew it. But after 2 years, he never called me into his office. So I determined that I wasn't going to get that conversation.
Oh, I see. So that was your bait to get called in.
That was my bait to get called in. Yeah. And he was well aware, but never did.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He was concerned about appearances. So I tried to be, give him an appearance that he should be concerned with.
Yeah.
But the conversation never happened. And so goes it in life sometimes.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting, how organizations deal with those ethical questions. And some of them are true and tried, and they have really high ethical standards. And if you cross that line, you're dealt with promptly and efficiently and effectively, and you either change behavior or you're gone.
Yep.
And other ones keep moving that line depending upon who you are within the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And boy, you asked previously, you know, what I learned from education is in my last teaching administrative job was as a dean of students at an all-boys military school. So I did student discipline for not just the kids that were threatened to be sent away, but actually were. And I learned a lot. And what I learned is that there are kids with a criminal mindset that grow up to be adults. And if you don't change or give them moral framework and boundaries, they will be one of two things. They'll be an extremely rich drug dealer that won't get caught because they're smart enough not to get caught, or they'll be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company.
I think there's a third choice. Or they'll be dead.
Or they'll be dead. Yeah, dead and in jail. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so for me, that moral fabric, you know, I want to be able to put my head down at night and sleep well.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have regrets of what I said to people or how I treated someone. And likewise, I want my business to reflect the same thing. I have pulled my coffee off of store shelves because the business owner didn't reflect my morals and standards that I have for my company and business and how people should be.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we all have to learn that moral character that each one of us has somehow. And we either learn it by ourselves or we have people who guide us and give us some founding principles to then, you know, modify that suit us. So that's that work that you were doing there, I think, is really, really important. And the fact that you sort of recognize that was part of that responsibility, I think, says a lot about your own moral character.
Yeah, it was absolutely extremely gratifying. And it was working with kids is a frustrating, demanding job, but likewise one with great rewards that you don't see until 10, 15 years down the road.
Yeah.
When all of a sudden they pop up on social media now and everybody, back when they were in school, said that they were going to never amount to anything or achieve anything, and you see that they are successful.
Yeah.
You know, some of my greatest rewards have come in education 10 years down the road, for sure.
Right, right. Yep. Well, Jim, I got to ask you one more question. So when I first met you, I knew you as Jetson.
Yes.
So, but your proper name is Jim Williamson.
Yeah, Jim Williams.
Jim Williams. So where did Jetson come from?
So when I started guiding here as an 18-year-old young buck.
River guide.
I had a bunch of friends 25, 30 years old, and they wore a lot of flannel, and I didn't mind wearing a bright blue fleece and have sunglasses on, and still had enough hair up top that I could rock a pretty good hockey mullet at the time. It's 1980s, so it's long gone now. And they thought I was from another planet, so they started calling me Jetson. And then other people said, well, I thought his name was Jim. And said, oh, no, it's Jim Jetson. Oh, yeah, it's Jim Jetson. And then I somehow had paychecks written to Jim Jetson. And I would go to the bank, and the cashier would say, hey, Jetson, how you doing? And I would cash my Jim Jetson paycheck. And still to this day, I will get checks written to Jim Jetson, and I can go into our bank and cash them as
yes.
Jim Jetson.
So it's not an alias.
No, but it has served as an alias at times. It's always good to have, you know, an alias if needed.
Yeah. Hey, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you, Jim. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for taking time to invite me into your beautiful home here in the Adirondacks and spend this hour with me discussing what you do.
It's awesome, man. Thanks for having me. And as soon as we turn this off, we're going to go do some fly fishing.
Perfect. Sounds good. Thanks, Jim.
Wow, Bela, what a story. What were your takeaways?
So I think I had two big key takeaways. There's two big key takeaways. And one thing I learned, because I went to his place for the interview, and I have known him, I've known Jim, or Jetson, as he is called, for quite a few years as a ski patroller. And I went to his 3-acre retreat, is what I would call it. And it turns out he built the whole thing, pounded every nail. And it was just one of those amazing things where I was in awe of the amount of time and energy it all must have taken for him to do that. And I think the link here is that, you know, he's had a couple challenges in his life. He had sort of a relationship that broke up in a not that nice a way. He clearly had some health issues that he shared with me even in more detail, you know, off the air, as they say. And, you know, he talked about that sitting in the parking lot and leaving the note in his car because he wasn't sure that he was going to be able to get back in it some days later and drive it away when he was at the hospital. So I think what he did there is he took those challenging things in life and he channeled them into his business and his house, his abode. You know, he channeled that energy. He didn't let it sort of derail his life, but he actually used it to help focus his life and make it into a better thing. So I just think that's sort of a great overall lesson in life, and sort of, to me, was a really great takeaway, and something, quite frankly, I didn't know about him at all. How about you, Mike?
Yeah, I agree, Bela, that, you know, a lot of people talk about entrepreneurship as something that's risk-taking, right, and stepping into the unknown. But a lot of people don't talk about the fact that entrepreneurship is about taking control over your own life, of being your own boss, like you said, right, of having some control over when all this uncertainty was going on or in his world, that his home was something he built with his own hands. And his business, his livelihood, was something that he could create with his own kind of moral compass and with his interest in how customer service should be and things like this. And with the agricultural product, the coffee itself, coming from a cooperative that he believed in and that that he had an interest in making sure that they were also having value created for them. So, you know, I think it's this really interesting look at entrepreneurship that, you know, we've had several guests, you know, over the last year or so that have had little parts of this. But in one big package here, Jim's a guy that used entrepreneurship, I think, as a way to take control of his life and his livelihood in a positive way that creates value and benefit for others around him, his suppliers, his community, his customers. So I think it was a really interesting story in that sense, and a really great example of this idea of why being an entrepreneur can really be a life-changing experience, and why people fail and keep trying again, right? There's something to it. And so this is kind of an interesting iteration of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent point, Mike. The other thing that struck me when we had this conversation with him was this notion of a niche business that's regionally branded, right? So he took his Upper Hudson coffee roasters and he branded it. You know, he's got one type of coffee that's a Roosevelt, i.e. named after the president, who had lots of connections to the Upper Hudson River and the Adirondacks. He took another one and branded it by the name of Barton. Barton is a big business person. There's Barton Mines, which up there, which mines like 90% of the garnet in the world. So he was really clever in sort of building this brand around a tourist geography, which then has people who come there want to buy some of that and take it home. Just like people buy t-shirts, right? The analogy I have is the t-shirt shops that exist in every tourist trap in the world, and they're branded to that location. You know, whether it be a Lake George t-shirt or a Myrtle Beach t-shirt or a New York City t-shirt. And it's very analogous to that. So he's built this brand up there that's focused sort of geographically from its identity. And since it's in a tourist / recreation area, it's one that he can then leverage into other locations because people want to be identified with that geographic area. And I thought that was pretty clever.
And the identity of his business, Bela, is his identity, right? It's how he came back home. And it has meaning for him. And that's really powerful, right? When you're selling something that you believe in, the coffee, but you've rooted your brand in a place that you believe in, that makes it a lot easier to sell what you're selling, right? Because there's some substance there. You know, by his own admission, he's not running a super efficient operation, right? It's small batch sizes, it's hand done. He's carrying bags upstairs, right? He's not trying to become the next Starbucks, right? He's just trying to provide an honest product in a location where there's a market for it with something that he's passionate about. And I think that's a great takeaway for people to think about, that there's room for people to do that. It's not a product that's like, oh, here's a brand new innovation, right? Or this is patented, right? It's not. He's selling coffee. Coffee's a commodity, but he's processing it away. I think that's, and I haven't tasted his coffee. Next time I get over your side, I'll have to pick some up next time I get over to your side of the Atlantic. But it's it's something that he believes in and he's doing with passion. And I think there's plenty of room for entrepreneurs who are passionate about their product and their brand and are making something good, right, and selling it at a fair price. So I love the idea of this idea of rooting his brand in the place where he himself came back to reroot, essentially.
Yeah, that was a great point about his brand is his identity. And, you know, taking his passion and turning it into a business. And, you know, I saw his coffee roaster. I'll try to post some pictures that I took up there. And, you know, it's amazing how small the operation actually is. And again, you know, we talked a little bit more off the air. And if you're happy and you sort of have found your place in life, it really doesn't take that much money to live. And I think that's another thing that Jim has figured out, that, you know what, and I think part of it has to do with some of the challenges and the health scare he had. I want to have this proper life-work balance where life comes first and work comes second. And I think he's done a great job at that. So it was a really good conversation from that perspective.
Do more with less, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I appreciate that. We could have a whole episode on work-life balance, because there's a very different approach to it over here from my experiences in Europe than what I experienced in the U.S. So that might be an interesting thing to bring a couple different people on to talk about work-life balance, and maybe we can put that in the hopper for future ideas.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I got a last question for you, Bella.
Yeah.
Did you catch any fish?
Oh, we did. We went fishing in the pond, and boy, that was great. Talk about, you know, this is like reading a book about, or I almost felt like I went to Walden Pond, you know, the famous book written by Thoreau. It was like, here we are, you know, sipping coffee and with a fly rod in our hand, like 50 yards from his house down the hill. And we actually caught some nice brook trout. He made the pond. He found the spring on his property. He made a pond out of it. He stocked it with some trout, and now he's got literally a pond out his back door where he feels like it. He can go down there and cast away.
Taking control, right? That's kind of the theme, right? I'm going to take control. I'm going to make my world what I want it to be.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good.
I'm glad you caught some fish, Bella. That was good. I'd hate for you to go all the way there and not catch anything.
You know? Yeah. Well, my normal fishing trips are there's a reason they call it fishing and not catching. So so for me, fishing is the usual way. So I caught more fish with him in an hour than I typically catch in half a day.
But you were set up for success, Bella. Right? That's the nice thing.
Yeah. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Shall we wrap it, Mike?
I think we should. Okay, that's it for this week. Thanks for spending time with us. We look forward to you joining us for our next episode. I'm signing off from Münster, Germany. Bela, how about you?
Well, I am signing off from upstate New York. And hey, if you have any questions or thoughts or suggestions, please reach out to us at belaandmike.com. And let me try that again. At bela.and.mike@gmail.com. There we go. I always stumble over that. And if you like what we're doing, hey, hit the subscribe button on your podcast app. It's free, and it helps us a little bit by driving up our listener numbers. And we hope you enjoyed this episode, and we look forward to having you join us next week for our next one. See you next week, Mike.
See you next week, Bela. And thanks again to our sponsors, Philip Lytle.
This podcast is produced for Mike and I by our friends at Busy Media of Schenectady, New York. They can be found at busymedia.co.